The South China Sea issue must be linked then with North Korea. It must be linked with the Taiwan issue and trade.
Keeping Korea safe while keeping China at bay. It's Friday, June 29th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Also ahead on our program, Myanmar's military face allegations of crimes against humanity, and a new app aims to reduce suicide. That and much more, all on today's VOA Asia. Thanks so much for joining us on VOA Asia. Before heading to Japan, U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis stopped in Seoul on Thursday to reassure South Korea of the U.S. commitment to its security.
U.S. commitment to the Republic of Korea remains ironclad, and the U.S. will continue to use the full range of diplomatic and military capabilities to uphold this commitment. And this includes maintaining the current U.S. force levels on the Korean peninsula.
The defense chief visited South Korea and Japan after spending 3 days in China, his first visit since taking his current post. He met with Chinese officials, including President Xi Jinping, who said China cannot lose even 1 inch of territory left behind by our ancestors. Professor Emeritus Carl Thayer of the University of New South Wales told VOA's Victor Beatty that China's assertiveness in the South China Sea is intertwined with other matters in a complicated bilateral relationship.
Xi is not in a position right now to back down or to accommodate American demands because of the ongoing trade war and the talks for cooperation on North Korea. This is the bluster coming from China, but it has to be taken seriously. But in the sense, the U.S. is not asking China to give up its claims to territory, nor is it disputing those. It's really asking or requesting China to stop militarizing those particular features.
What is the U.S. strategy going forward on the South China Sea?
Well, I think it's a work in progress. Secretary Mattis's trip, as we all know, has been the first in 4 years by a U.S. defense secretary. And before going there, he made clear that I think that the main object he wanted to listen was to establish a strategic dialogue that was transparent with China. And he certainly has, in public at least, got Xi Jinping to talk about trust and preventing misunderstanding, and that they both value military-to-military relations at a time of tensions. That's good to see where the bilateral mill-to-mill relationships go and talk about these things. But nonetheless, the strategy on the South China Sea, outlined in the U.S. National Security and Defense Strategy, is that the U.S. will lead a coalition of partners and allies to ensure freedom of navigation and to push back against China's predatory behavior and, from the Shangri-La Dialogue, coercion and intimidation. Stepped up freedom of navigation patrols. There's been 7 under the Trump administration, more than double Obama. Most recent involved, not all the previous 6 ones, involved destroyers. The second was a destroyer and a cruiser. And we don't know exactly what they did, but they did naval maneuvers near Woody and Tree Island in the Paracels. That's in the north. Lincoln Island to the east and Triton Island to the southwest. So that's quite a bit of the Paracels that got in China's face. Further on, the U.S. has maintained a continuous bomber presence. B-52s not only from Guam flying towards the China coast and returning Okinawa and back, but from Diego Garcia overflying the South China Sea. And combat aircraft carrier groups like the current one visiting the Philippines.
That's not going to change the situation on the ground, though, is it?
No, the infrastructure is there on 3 islands, 3-kilometer airstrips, hangars for 24 planes, including nuclear bombers, refuelers, airborne early warning and control craft. But if we take militarization as a spectrum, China has not yet put in warfighting capabilities, although it's put in surface-to-air missiles, anti-ship cruise missiles. The strategy, I think, would be to put enough pressure on China not to militarize by moving from more or less defensive postures, which the U.S. provides rather provocative, into offensive capability. The South China Sea issue must be linked then with North Korea. It must be linked with the Taiwan issue and trade. So nothing is going to be solved immediately, and it has to be, I think, consistent U.S. pressure once the U.S. has sorted out the priorities. And since North Korea is on the top, I think that has top priority.
Carl Thayer of the University of New South Wales speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. These are the top Asia stories currently on voanews.com. Human Rights Watch links two of Cambodia's highest military figures to murders, tortures, and rapes. Afghan authorities reject Russian claims that thousands of Islamic State fighters are consolidating their presence in that country. Thai rescue workers will drill a narrow shaft into a cave where 12 schoolboys are believed to be trapped by floodwaters. And environmentalists express concern over India's fast-tracking of new coal-fired power plants. Expanded coverage of these and much more at voanews.com. VOA Asia continues. Senior Myanmar military officials, including the commanders of its defense services and army, should face trial for crimes against humanity over the treatment of Rohingya minorities, Amnesty International said in a report on Tuesday. Reuters' Ed Giles reports.
A top rights group says senior military officials in Myanmar should face trial for crimes against humanity over the treatment of Rohingya minorities. Amnesty International released a report into Myanmar's military on Tuesday that says the country's officials committed crimes against humanity and asks for members of the country's military to be referred to the International Criminal Court.
Make absolutely no mistake, these are crimes against humanity. We are talking about rape, murder, torture, forced starvation, the use of landmines, and targeted large-scale burning of villages.
About 700,000 Muslim Rohingya have fled to Bangladesh from largely Buddhist Myanmar since a military crackdown last August. The UN's called the crackdown a, quote, textbook example of ethnic cleansing. Amnesty said their investigation identified 13 specific Myanmar individuals who Amnesty claims are responsible.
The atrocities committed against the Rohingya implicate every level of the Myanmar military.
A spokesman for the Myanmar government was not available for comment. Myanmar has repeatedly denied the allegations and says their armed forces were responding to attacks from Rohingya militants. A separate Reuters investigation published this week gave a comprehensive account of the roles played by two light infantry divisions in the offensive. The report used information gleaned from social media posts to detail the actions of elite troops in Rakhine State and how closely tied those troops are to the most senior ranks of the country's military. Meanwhile, two Reuters journalists who were jailed in December in Myanmar remain in prison in Yangon. They were jailed while reporting on the killing of 10 Rohingya men and boys by Rakhine Buddhists and security forces. The reporters face up to 14 years in prison for allegedly violating Myanmar's Official Secrets Act.
Reuters' Ed Giles reporting. Happening now in Asia, Asian stocks closed lower on Thursday, with China markets falling back into negative territory as investors examined developments related to the U.S. stance on foreign investment amid lingering trade war concerns. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Happy to have you with us on VOA Asia today. The retirement of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy gives President Donald Trump an opportunity to choose a replacement that may better suit his political agenda. VOA's Zlatica Hoke reports.
Kennedy is retiring after 30 years of serving on the court. He has often cast the decisive vote on major issues, including abortion, gun control, voting rights, and gay marriage. He was appointed by Republican President Ronald Reagan, and he is loyal to the Republican Party, says law professor David Abraham.
Justice Kennedy's soft spot for gay rights has created the impression that he is a moderate, and certainly in comparison to Justices Alito or Thomas, he might be described that way. Nevertheless, in all of the key opinions of the last generation, Justice Kennedy has been the fifth vote for these conservative positions.
Abraham says Kennedy may have chosen his retirement time to secure the appointment of another conservative judge before the election of a new Congress in November.
It's not surprising that he would choose to retire while he knew that the Republican administration enjoyed a majority in the Senate, so that his successor would indeed come from the ranks of the Republican Party and its current leader, the president.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer warned Wednesday that another conservative judge could help overturn the court's major decisions on women's reproductive rights, health care, and others.
Americans should make it clear that they will not tolerate a nominee chosen from President Trump's preordained list, selected by powerful special interests, who will reverse the progress we have made over the decades.
Some analysts say Trump's choice may well make the Supreme Court one of the most conservative in its history. Law professor Paul Schiff Berman told VOA that such a conservative court may be challenged by a large segment of American society.
History suggests that when the court gets too far ahead or behind American popular opinion, its legitimacy gets challenged. And I think we are heading into a period where that is likely to occur.
Berman says challenges are especially likely if Democrats gain a majority in the Senate during the November election. President Trump said Wednesday his administration will begin the search for a new Supreme Court justice immediately. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
And you're listening to VOA Asia. This news alert from VOA Asia. As South Korea's football team celebrated its 2-0 upset over defending champion Germany, two Telemundo hosts were caught on camera making racist, slant-eyed gestures. As a result, they've been suspended by the network. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for all the top stories. This is VOA Asia. And VOA Asia continues. Conservation and animal protection organizations are alarmed by the slaughter last week of a 67-foot endangered fin whale by an Icelandic whaling company in defiance of the international ban on commercial whaling. The hunt is Iceland's first in 3 years and marks the start of a whaling season that could see as many as 238 of the creatures killed. International Edition's Laurie London asks Kate O'Connell, a marine wildlife consultant with Animal Welfare Institute, how unusual this all is.
It's unfortunately not unusual. Iceland resumed commercial whaling in 2006 for two different species. One is the endangered fin whale, and the other is the minke whale. The minke whale is a very small whale species. Hunts for the minke whale have been ongoing in every year since 2006. For fin whaling, the main whaling company, Kvaler, actually stopped whaling after the 2015 season, and so we were very hopeful that the company was not going to resume the hunt for this endangered animal.
Has Iceland responded in any way to the outcry by environmental and animal organizations?
I think it's mixed. Whereas about 10 years ago, I think it would have been far more expected to get just a completely negative response to the calls by the environmentalists to stop whaling. I think we're seeing a real sea change in Iceland in the past few years. Whale watching has become much more important to the local economy. It generates about $20 million a year in revenue for Iceland. And we're seeing a real shift in people's attitudes towards whaling. And a recent poll that was conducted just a few weeks ago within Iceland found the support for commercial whaling within the country at its lowest level ever. Only about a third of Icelanders actually support the resumption of the hunt for fin whales.
I also noticed when I was there that many of the restaurants actually, which was, it was shocking as an American to see something like that, but on menus, the minke whale on the menu.
It is deeply upsetting, and I think one of the good stories to come out of Iceland recently in terms of the consumption of whale meat is that consuming whale meat has actually dropped in Iceland significantly, including for tourists. There's a wonderful program that's run by a group called Ice Whale, which is the organization of Icelandic whale watching vessels, and they've been promoting this program called Meet Us, Don't Eat Us since 2009. And when they first began, over 40% of tourists polled said, yeah, sure, I'll try whale meat. I have no problem with it. But through this long-term education program and doing outreach on the whale watching vessel, talking connecting with people in the street, putting out local ads, getting local Icelandic folk people to come up and say, we don't eat whale meat. Why should you eat whale meat in Iceland? That figure has dropped from 40% down to about 11% in the most recent poll.
Is there any repercussion for Iceland as far as this being in defiance of the international ban on commercial whaling?
They have been under review by the U.S. government under the Obama administration. There had been a decision to do something called a certification of Iceland, in which it was found that, yes, indeed, Iceland is defying both the International Whaling Commission ban on whaling and also the CITES, which is the Convention on International Trade and Endangered Species ban on trade in whale products. And through that certification, the president at that time made the decision that Iceland would experience very strong diplomatic sanctions. So Iceland was not invited to a very important oceans conference that was hosted by the U.S. Every time that U.S. officials met with their Icelandic counterpart, they would raise the issue of whaling and trade in whale products. Also, within the European Union, there was the drafting of a very strong political statement called a demarche, which is a diplomatic protest, and that was sent to Iceland. And so there's been quite a lot of high-level political pressure brought against the country. But also what we're increasingly seeing are a lot of people questioning, is this now the time for me to say, will I keep visiting Iceland to do whale watching? And, you know, as I stated previously, maybe now is the time for Iceland to make its own determination that whale watching definitely is more important to the country and its future and its image than whaling.
The Animal Welfare Institute's Kate O'Connell. Suicide is now the 10th leading cause of death in the United States, that according to the Centers for Disease Control. But now, two teenagers have come up with a way to try and reduce the suicide rate with a smartphone app. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo has that story.
The news that celebrity chef Anthony Bourdain and fashion designer Kate Spade had taken their own lives sent shockwaves around the world. Their suicides happened around the same time the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued a report showing a 25% increase in suicides in the U.S. since 1999.
The data really speak volumes that the problem is getting worse. And so what is really needed is suicide prevention.
Charlie and Hannah Lucas are the creators of the Not Okay app, a digital tool to help address the problem.
The Not Okay app is essentially a digital panic button that, when pressed, it sends a text message that says, "Hey, I'm not okay. Come call me, text me, or come check up on me."
That message goes to a pre-selected group of five close contacts along with the sender's GPS location and directions. The two siblings came up with the idea after Hannah struggled with an illness that caused her to faint.
It's postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, and basically it just causes me to pass out. I mean, I missed a lot of school because I was always the sick kid, doctor appointments, emergency rooms, IV infusions, blood tests, everything.
Hannah says she was often bullied at school because of her condition.
I was always in fear, you know. It got to a point where I was afraid to leave my bed. And I just developed really bad depression and anxiety. I mean, I'm talking eating disorders, self-harm, and multiple suicide attempts. It was terrible.
The next day after she told me her idea, I've been helpless for too long because whenever she passed out, I couldn't catch her. I couldn't drive her to the doctor. I couldn't do anything for her. So my first thought was, why not? And on that very day, I started doing the wireframe, which was basically the prototype version of the app.
Hannah is doing better now. And she says the app is not just for preventing suicide. It can be used by anyone who's not okay.
No matter what you're going through, I mean, you need to keep that contact with people because isolating yourself is just going to make everything worse, no matter what it is.
The two have won several awards for the app, including one recently from Mental Health America. It's been downloaded more than 15,000 times since it was released in the U.S. earlier this year. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
Many elementary schools around the United States have started gardens to give their young students hands-on experience with growing and then eating vegetables. The Ecology Club at P.B. Smith Elementary School in Warrenton, Virginia, started its garden a couple years ago. As Faiza El-Masri tells us, the school's beautiful green space got a valuable addition last year, a garden filled with plants that attract butterflies. Faith Lapidus narrates.
Keely Scott has always been involved in school activities and clubs. Last year, the high school junior needed a project for her Girl Scout club. She went back to her old elementary school, P.B. Smith, and created a butterfly garden.
We had a butterfly bush in my house, and we actually had to cut it down when we built our deck, and I missed it so much, and I loved looking at all the butterflies, and I was like, wow, well, we have a decreased population in our area, and I thought, oh, well, I can fix that. So I developed this idea, and Miss Denise supported me 100%.
Barbara Denis is the ecology club teacher.
One of our missions for the ecology club is to be good stewards of the earth, and they can say those words, but they don't really understand them until they actually do something.
Does anybody know what that is going to turn into? I know we said swallowtail, but do you know
tiger
what a
swallowtail?
Tiger swallowtail. What colors?
Black. It would be orange.
Orange. Now you're thinking of monarch, but it's a yellow. It's got some black and yellow, even a little bit of. It is. It is right. It's our state insect.
In the school's garden, kids help plant, grow, and harvest a variety of herbs and vegetables. They give part of the produce to the school's cafeteria and donate the rest to a local food bank. In the butterfly garden, they learn about butterflies.
We talk about the need for a certain plant for an organism to survive. We talk about the cycles because we've got eggs, we've got our larva caterpillar, and then we've got this chrysalis, and then they're waiting patiently for it to emerge.
The students' patience was rewarded when monarch butterflies landed in their garden. Monarchs lay their eggs only on milkweed plants, which have been disappearing due to the use of herbicides and weather conditions. That means monarchs have fewer places to stop on their migration journey between Canada and Mexico.
We had probably about a dozen monarchs come, and in years past we've never had any. So we feel like we have definitely been a good station for the monarchs. And then once they emerge from their chrysalis, then they fly away, and they know where to go. That's amazing. They know where to go. I don't know how to get to Mexico, but they do. And they follow the sun. And the kids had helped in that. All right, be gentle. Be gentle. Because they've only laid their eggs recently, so they aren't mature enough. You're going to be really gentle.
Keenan Whitney says he gets so excited that he tells his family all about what he learns in the garden.
I only thought they pollinated one flower for some reason, but then I learned that they pollinated a lot of flowers.
They'll be butterflies soon, but they have to be as big as, say, that.
Are there any in here?
11-year-old Amelia Jacob says every time she and her classmates visit the butterfly garden, they learn something new and amazing.
We saw several swallowtails caterpillars, and there's this really fat one that should be turning into a chrysalis soon. I'm quite surprised at how it can turn into a chrysalis. And then just how does its body form into the beautiful body of a butterfly?
School principal Linda Payne Smith says she loves hearing comments like that.
We want the kids to take ownership of those gardens and come back, just like our senior Keely Scott has come back and created the butterfly garden. We hope that their love for the environment started at P.B. Smith, and we have seen it evolve. And so our hope is that it will continue.
While they're getting excited about gardening and closely watching the butterflies' cycle of life, the kids realize they're doing something to help their communities. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
And you've been listening to VOA Asia. You can get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. Download our podcast and take VOA Asia with you. You can find us at voanews.com. By the way, let us hear from you. Our address email is VOA Asia Facebook, actually VOA Asia Facebook, and our email address is voaasia@voanews. For all of us here on the VOA Asia team, thank you so much for being with us this Friday. We hope we'll see us again on Monday. And until then, have a great weekend.